It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. How you doing, everybody? The legendary free speech lawyer Floyd Abrams is with us now. We'll get his take on the Supreme Court ruling this morning on patenting the breast cancer gene. We'll get his take on the NSA surveillance and Edward Snowden situation. How Daniel Ellsberg-y Pentagon Papers-y is this really under the law, in his opinion? And on Citizens United, which Abrams considers a pro-free speech ruling, Floyd Abrams has a new book called Friend of the Court, On the Front Lines with the First Amendment. It's a collection of his speeches and writings. Hi, Floyd. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
So, Myriad Patent. That's the case. The Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics. This is about whether human genes, in particular the BRCA1 and BRCA2 so-called breast cancer genes, can be patented by a private company. And holy moly, the court was unanimous.
Yeah, pretty rare these days. Unanimous and important. I mean, they really are saying in the clearest language that you can't patent something that occurs naturally. You can't patent a gene. Even if you do a lot of work, even if you discover it, even if the public is greatly served by what you did, but you know, that which is natural remains natural and unpatentable.
If it's a natural isolated strand of DNA or type of DNA, it's not patentable. If it's synthetic DNA, it is patentable. Do you understand the distinction?
Not more than a sentence worth. The distinction it really is if you created it, you can patent it.
Synthetic carbon copy of BRCA or any other gene?
Well, the closer it is to the gene itself, the clearer it is that you can't patent it.
Right.
But the more you've done, the greater the add-on. The more that it's just not part of your body, the more willing the court is, and as you say, unanimously, to say this is your creation.
Do you understand how the company Myriad Genetics, would have benefited from having those patents? Does it mean they would have a monopoly on BRCA1 and BRCA2 testing, so anyone who follows, you know, Angelina Jolie's lead and gets those genetic tests would actually be paying Myriad?
I don't know if it would cover testing as such, but I have to say it sounds it. I mean, I think that's the reason that sort of question it illustrates why the court, I don't want to say they found it easy, but why they were able all to agree on the proposition that it just can't be patentable if what you've done is to, as it were, discover a part of the human body.
And my understanding is that Myriad claimed that they innovated the way you can isolate those genes.
Right, and that is precisely what the court said is not patentable.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That you can... You can deserve a lot of credit. You can be brilliant. You can, in effect, have served the public. But that which is part of our bodies is per se not patentable.
And my understanding is that Myriad does, in effect, have a monopoly on the test right now, and this kind of breaks that monopoly.
Yeah.
So we will see how that plays out in the marketplace. Scalia only joined in part. I'm not sure which part he dissented on.
I think what he was saying is, I don't really understand all this stuff. And so I'm not signing on to the science, but this opinion sounds fine to me, is what he was saying.
And in this unanimous decision, Clarence Thomas wrote the decision for the court.
Yeah.
It's so unusual for him to speak from the bench. Is it unusual for him to write decisions?
Not really. Not really. Remember, in a case like this, it's up to the Chief Justice who to assign it to. That's one of the roles, one of the powers of the Chief Justice. and he picked Justice Thomas, and it's a very short opinion, and it's which is a good thing, not a bad thing. Sometimes these opinions run so long that they dilute their message by their very length. That's not true here.
If he was picked to write this opinion, is that a clue that Thomas isn't going to be picked to write one of the other big decisions yet to come down, including a big affirmative action decision? You know, and he's so conservative on affirmative action. And you wrote a brief on that to the court, right?
I wrote a brief for a group of Catholic colleges, Fordham, Georgetown, Notre Dame, urging the court not to strike down affirmative action and urging the court that really the court ought to stay out, that this is a First Amendment or at least First Amendment-like situation, that universities ought to be free of that level of judicial or legislative oversight, and that this is what they think is good for education, that the court should let that stand.
And there are all these big decisions yet to come before the end of the term. At the end of this month, that affirmative action case, Fisher versus University of Texas, the Shelby County versus Holder, that's the case that might nullify part of the Voting Rights Act. There's adoptive couple versus baby girl. At issue is whether an unwed biological father who initially renounced his custodial rights to his daughter can rely on a federal law to block her adoption now that he wants the custody again. And there's DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act on gay marriage, and California's Prop 8. So what's taking them? They got to go on vacation soon.
Well, what they usually do is to go until the end, the end of June around. People sort of laugh about them running out of town, so they're not around anymore to get the criticism while they're still there.
We remember last year after the Obamacare ruling came down right at the end, and literally that day or the next morning, Justice Roberts flew off to Iceland, I think it was, for some kind of symposium, and he wasn't around to talk to the press. Not that he would have talked to the press.
Yeah, I mean, he also said that he was protected by the natural beauties of the area he was in.
Could the Prop 8 case, if they throw out California's Proposition 8 called Hollingsworth versus Perry, could that in effect legalize gay marriage nationwide? Would that say no state may bar people from marrying?
Well, that's one of the issues in front of them. I mean, they've got two big but separate issues. One is a Prop 8 issue where they could say that in effect you can't overturn the right to marry which the state had previously authorized. But the other is flat out, does the Constitution protect gay marriage so that no state can ban it?
So they could decide for gay marriage in effect that way, or if they throw out the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, that might be on states' rights grounds, which is to say, hey, if people are legally married in one state, Washington, you can't deny federal benefits to them. Yeah. But in a way, that would reaffirm Prop 8 because it gives the states the power to decide.
Yes, this is one of these cases where liberals and progressives have to decide what they think of federalism to some extent to come back to the notion that states have certain rights, etc.
My guest is the legendary First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams. His new book, Friend of the Court, on the front lines with the First Amendment. And let's go to something else in the news, very relevant to things that you have in this book. Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers about the Vietnam War, has been out there this week embracing Edward Snowden as the moral equivalent of him. He has said the same thing about Private Bradley Manning, who leaked those thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks. But you have stuff in this book about how you do not see the WikiLeaks document dump as the equivalent of Ellsberg. Why not?
Right. What I was talking about was not so much the First Amendment side of it, but whether to honor, what to make of WikiLeaks and in effect, Private Manning. And my view on that is essentially very troubled. I think WikiLeaks has behaved in a manner that has sometimes and too often been reckless. I think just handing out hundreds of thousands of documents is dangerous. I think that when, for example, let us assume that it's Private Manning is the only source of this, when he gave them 92,000 American military telegrams and the telecommunications of one sort or enough of American soldiers in Afghanistan, and WikiLeaks very quickly released about 77,000 of those, and Mr. Assange was asked, well, have you read them all? Have you and your people read them all? He said, well, we've read about 2,000. And a journalist said, well, how can you release 75,000 that you haven't read? And his answer was, we have no reason to think that they'll threaten anyone's life, which now I'm speaking is probably true. But my conclusion from that is, look, we're not dealing with journalists here. Journalists don't hand out documents. But my other conclusion is that while I think it is reckless to just flip into the world stage materials you haven't even read simply because you got them and because someone thought they were secret initially, that doesn't mean they're not entitled to First Amendment protection. I mean, even if you view WikiLeaks, as I generally do, as sort of more political activist than journalist, political activists get First Amendment protection. And indeed, I think the way the Supreme Court is moving is that we're likely to see sort of very robust protection in general for the First Amendment, but across the board, the journalists are unlikely to get sort of special protection because of what they do, and that call them political activists or just any speaker is going to wind up having very broad rights, but not sort of special rights for any group. And I think the court, that the majority of the court, the current majority, has made that clear that that's where they're coming from.
You do suggest in the book that WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange could be charged under the Espionage Act if he induced Manning, keyword induced, to leak classified national security documents to him. Are you actually applying that risk to a publisher, even one like Assange, who you don't respect very much, but who, as you said a minute ago, you think still deserves First Amendment protection?
I hope it doesn't happen. I meant what I said, that he could be charged, and I'm concerned about charging him on that theory, in part because to that extent he is indistinguishable from publishers in general, publishers perhaps I think better of. But he is subject to. I mean, look, we're learning from the Manning case that the extreme charge, not just of misusing classified information, but seeking to help enemies of the United States, is something the Department of Justice is prepared to use against a leaker. And WikiLeaks is in a sort of a mixed position. They are half recipient and half leaker because they provide to the, call it the establishment press, that which they receive.
By that intent to harm standard and aiding and abetting the enemies of the United States standard, I wonder if you think today's developments regarding Edward Snowden move his status in that respect. For people who haven't heard this yet, he gave another media interview, and this one was to the South China Post, Morning Post, an English-language newspaper in Hong Kong, and he told them about new stuff, about alleged cyber espionage that the United States is carrying out that he had access to proof about, against China in particular. So does that move him from potential whistleblower or more benign leaker into aiding and abetting an enemy camp?
Well, it puts him at greater risk of that, yes. Look, in the Manning case, the government has to go through a rather tortured or at least not self-evident sort of analysis. They say he released this information. He must have known that al-Qaeda could get it and could read it and therefore he fits within the helping the enemy section.
Right, and I don't know if China would be defined as an enemy anyway. Yeah, our relations are complex.
Think back at the time the Rosenbergs committed their act. Russia was an ally in the war, so this is a very very tough area. One of the reasons, you know, we got this old espionage law passed 1918, really very unclear as to what it covers and doesn't cover. It's phrased so broadly, so overbroadly, that you know we can't live with it the way it reads. So the courts narrow it to make it constitutional. And nonetheless, and maybe because of it, leave it very vague. I mean, there's language in there about, information relating to national defense. I mean, you can't be a crime for the New York Times to be at risk every day when it writes articles about national defense.
My guest, Floyd Abrams, attorney, author of Friend of the Court. We can take some phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC on any of the things that we've been discussing, 212-433-9692, or for that matter, anything you always wanted to ask the legendary Floyd Abrams, but he didn't happen to be in your living room or at your dinner table, 212-433-9692, or post your question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Before we take a break and then go on to some other things, Citizens United, your view of the First Amendment in general and how the left sometimes abandons it, the right sometimes abandon it. One other curious thing about the Snowden case today is his relationship with Hong Kong. In the South China Morning Post article, he acknowledges still being in Hong Kong, and on the prospect of being extradited to the United States, he says, quote, "My intention is to ask the courts and people of Hong Kong to decide my fate. I have no reason to doubt your system. I have faith in Hong Kong's rule of law," unquote. And, oh, boy, do you know anything about Hong Kong law or enough to have an opinion about that?
Well, there are two things I think we ought to know about Hong Kong law. First, it is generally, free speech oriented. But second, Hong Kong's part of China now, and China has stepped in certain circumstances with respect to Hong Kong judicial rulings. Second, the U.S. has a treaty with Hong Kong about extradition. And so if the U.S. asked Hong Kong, again, that now being China in a sense, to send him here, there is this treaty. It does have an exception, as most of the European countries have, for, quote, political acts. I could just see a lengthy argument in the courts in Hong Kong
over whether
he's a political prisoner or accused for political reasons.
Or if he's a criminal under U.S. law.
Correct. And by the way, that's the same in most European countries. I mean, if Julian Assange went to Sweden, or indeed in the UK as well, and there were a judicial proceeding where the U.S. was asking for his extradition, certainly one of the things he would be saying, and I'm sure that the folks in the Department of Justice have already thought long and hard about this, is that this was a sort of political prosecution, or even to put it in a more benign way even, that he was committing a political act rather than one that the European countries ought to recognize as a crime.
Lawyer Floyd Abrams, your calls, Citizens United, the right, the left, and the First Amendment, coming up, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. More with Floyd Abrams in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the legendary First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams. His new book, Friend of the Court, on the front lines with the First Amendment. And the breaking Supreme Court news this morning, the court has held that natural isolated DNA is not patentable. This had to do with the so-called breast cancer gene and whether that could be patented for the purpose of developing BRCA gene tests. Synthetic DNA is patentable, but not the natural isolated DNA that the company Myriad Genetics wanted to patent. The court ruled unanimously against them on that score. But we're talking about all kinds of things with Floyd Abrams. And here is a doctor on Long Island, Miguel. Doctor, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Brian.
Go ahead.
I want to ask Mr. Abrams, and this is really on pure philosophical grounds, not just kidding. He thinks that corporations are people or persons. Can he explain to me how can I do a colonoscopy to a corporation? Or for that matter, to take an MRI of the brain? And then, if corporations are people, can the DNA of a corporation be patented?
Or, Miguel, as the protest sign I once saw at a demonstration read, "I'll believe a corporation is a person when Texas executes one." But Floyd Abrams, I guess this relates to free speech purposes, Citizens United included. Do you believe a corporation is a person under the law?
Well, of course it's not a person, but we protect speech, not speakers. The whole essence of the First Amendment is that we are protecting freedom of speech in general, wherever it comes from, whoever or whatever it emanates from. Now, I should say I spent the better part of my professional life representing corporations that I'll bet you think should have First Amendment rights. Corporations like the New York Times Company, corporations like CBS. I don't think anyone would doubt.
Especially protected, though, under the First Amendment, freedom of the press.
Freedom of the press, but that is not always and only the basis of affording legal protection. I don't think that the press itself, press entities, are the only ones that have rights of free speech, and the Supreme Court has never thought so. I mean, they've certainly thought that a pamphleteer is entitled to it. Call that speech or call that press. They've certainly thought, you know, lots of other entities and institutions are entitled to it. Justice Kennedy's majority opinion in Citizens United cited 25 cases in which corporations had been afforded First Amendment rights. And indeed, even Justice Stevens' dissent didn't take issue with that. He thought that as regards corporations, the sort of competing interest of, call it election purity, can trump or overcome the First Amendment rights. But the notion that corporations can have and have long been recognized as having First Amendment rights didn't start or anything like start with Citizens United.
And I don't think you have to even get to this philosophical distinction as to whether corporations should have any free speech rights, therefore campaign spending rights, to argue against Citizens United. You cite in your book Cass Sunstein, former Obama advisor and law professor, what he called his New Deal on the First Amendment regarding campaign spending, that restricting political spending by very rich corporations and other interests doesn't restrict speech. It actually enables more speech by making sure different points of view can see the light of day and don't get drowned out in the public square by others' wealth. Personally, I tend to buy that argument as not anti-free speech but pro-free speech, but you do not.
Right, right. I mean, the First Amendment that I have in mind is one which is more dubious about and more concerned about letting the government open that door than Cass Sunstein and others, you know, who view it through that particular policy basis. This is a serious and difficult issue and argument, because you certainly can make the case that there'll ultimately be more speech, at least of more people, if some people and organizations are kept from speaking as much. I mean, Mike Bloomberg spent $170 million in one of his campaigns. According to the Supreme Court rulings, you can't corrupt yourself, so there's no basis at all, that the Supreme Court has said, to keep an individual
right.
from speaking as much as he wants and therefore from spending.
So people on the Cass Sunstein side would say that issue needs to be dealt with too
absolutely.
At some point.
No, absolutely. And I just cite that because I think that's the same issue.
Yes. Yes. Paul in Stony Brook, you're on WNYC with Floyd Abrams. Hello.
Hi there. So we've been discussing a bit about how the First Amendment rights apply to leakers like Mr. Snowden. And I'm curious what Mr. Abrams has to say about how the sort of government programs that have been uncovered now by Mr. Snowden, how these affect our rights as citizens, specifically in regards to the First Amendment.
I would say that I would look first to the Fourth Amendment, unreasonable search and seizure, rather than the First Amendment. It could affect the First Amendment in terms of chilling speech, you know, that you may not speak out if you know the government could be listening. But I think the sort of better, almost easier argument is that if you know that the government is keeping track of who calls who, what number calls what number, and for what length of time, and where the people are, that itself is a significant deprivation of personal privacy as protected in the Fourth Amendment. Now, there is a Supreme Court case about that, in which the court in 1979, by a 5-3 vote, said that's not true. The majority of the court said we don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to our telephone records. I think that's wrong. I think the dissenters were right, but that is the law as of today.
Do you think that Director of National Intelligence James Clapper may have been guilty of perjury in a real legal sense when he denied the existence of these programs when asked the direct question by Senator Wyden the other month?
And he said that when the question was, are you gathering information about individuals?
About not, millions or tens of millions of individuals. And he said not wittingly.
Yeah, I must say I think that perjury is a stronger word than I'm ready to use, but there's another statute with respect to providing false testimony, which doesn't require the same level of bad state of mind. It's awful close. It's not an excuse that it was classified. I mean, that is just not a proper basis for providing false testimony.
Why not?
Because he should have said, I can't answer that question, or I'd rather go into closed session, or something like that. And you're just not allowed, you want to use the most benign word, to fib under oath because you think it's protecting the country to do so. There are other ways to do it.
Because the law requires you to not disclose.
Exactly.
Just as Senator Wyden, an opponent of the program, would not disclose the program.
Right, right. But I don't think it would be a defense, a valid legal defense, for him to say, I was following the law that in effect required this to be secret. The way to follow that law is to say, Senator, I cannot answer that question.
And I'm sorry, what's that statute other than perjury?
Section 1001 of the Federal Criminal Code, which makes it a crime to provide false information to a federal official.
Floyd Abrams, who has memorized at least 1001 sections of the Federal Code. David in Springfield, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, thank you very much. Abrams, I wanted to raise a different issue with you. We have a federal system now with 50 states, and it's not clear to me whether there is great utility in the 21st century of maintaining structure. Do you think we're long overdue for a dialogue as to how we organize ourselves for good governance in the 21st century, perhaps in a way other than having 50 independent states of various sizes?
Federalism. And, of course, one of the Tea Party's favorite amendments to the Constitution is the 10th, which reserves all other rights for the states except the ones that are enumerated for the federal government. Right.
That's one of the reasons I asked the question.
Right. It's a big, ambitious question that you've asked. Look, I think it is very much in the interest of public understanding and on a very long-range basis of potentially changing certain well-established and constitutionally required in the Constitution as it currently exists pieces of old binding documents on us. The fact that we had states before we had a federal government is not an answer. That's one of the answers to why it's unlikely it'll be changed. But look, we can have constitutional amendments. We could sit down again. I'm serious, and have a constitutional convention and talk about redrafting. What you raise is a serious issue. I understand it's not, no one's going to sign on to it right now in terms of getting rid of the states. But what you raise is a very serious issue, which is well worth continued serious public discourse.
If they ever actually had a constitutional convention again, I'll bet you'd think that the First Amendment would be at serious risk.
The First Amendment would be the first to go.
And I want to conclude by reading one paragraph from your book and have you reflect on it, and then I know you got to go. Those who toil in the vineyards of the First Amendment law come upon a wide range of temporary allies. Liberals fly First Amendment flags in cases in which the right of the press to publish information related to national security is involved. Conservatives retire the colors in such cases. Conservatives march to defend the First Amendment, conservatives, in cases involving limitations on political advertising published close to elections. Liberals see only money and not speech in those cases. So you're a near absolutist on the First Amendment? Is that how you'd put it?
I don't know how I put it. I take the First Amendment very seriously, the way it reads and the way I think it should be read. I think one of the great problems that we have with respect to free speech in America is that people don't really accept the notion that speech that they really disapprove of, that speech that they really think does harm, really should be protected. I think that we have to keep fighting ourselves to assure that we really mean it when we say the First Amendment is all about protecting, as Justice Holmes said, the speech that we hate. We have to allow speech even if we disagree, even if we think it's really wrong-headed. And I would hope that everyone would agree, not just verbally, but ultimately in a very deep psychic sense.
But not fire in a crowded theater.
Not falsely crying fire in a crowded theater.
Ooh. Floyd Abrams, his new book, Friend of the Court, on the front lines with the First Amendment. I so enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, for something completely different, Amy Stewart, author of The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. And she and the bartender from the Richardson will help us identify the first ever official plant-based cocktail of The Brian Lehrer Show. Stay with us.